Brought to you by Oppenheimer Funds, the right way to invest. Explore long-term opportunities at oppenheimerfunds.com.
Welcome to Bloomberg Masters in Politics. I'm Betsy Fisher Martin.
And I'm Tammy Haddad.
And today we have an all-female edition of the show. We will talk to the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who has presided over this long Democratic primary that has gotten quite contentious and personal in the last few weeks. And then we will speak to journalist and author Kate Anderson Brower about her new book about the modern first ladies and their roles as masters in politics.
Coming off a big win for Hillary Clinton in New York, her delegate lead looks nearly insurmountable. But the Sanders campaign, with its massive crowds and massive amounts of money from supporters, is not backing down. Tensions on both sides are at an all-time high. The task of uniting the party to prevent the Republicans from gaining the White House will be more difficult than ever. Today, we'll speak with the woman at the center of it all, DNC Chairman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, to get a peek inside the race. Welcome, Chairman.
Thank you so much, Tammy. It's great to be with both you and Betsy.
Okay, It's 19 primaries to go. What's your plan?
Well, we are ready because simultaneous to managing this Democratic primary nominating contest, we've been preparing for our eventual nominee and making sure that we can launch one of the two, whoever ultimately wins the primary, from Philadelphia to the White House. We've been working with our state parties all across the country. We've been building out our coordinated campaigns. We've been strengthening our voter file. And really, because the Republicans have a lot of chaos going on, and they seem a little bit more, you know, twisted up in the process of actually nominating their candidate, you know, we're going to be able to avoid all of that because ultimately we're going to be united in Philadelphia behind our ultimate nominee.
Well, uniting is sometimes easier said than done. So I guess my question to you is, in light of this campaign over the last few weeks that has obviously gotten a little more heated back and forth with the attacks, how would you propose that the party come together with whoever that eventual nominee is going to be?
Well, you know, at the point that we're at in the process, Betsy, it's understandable. Of course, you know, both of our candidates feel passionately about the issues that are important to them, and they've taken slightly different approaches to achieving the same goals. But ultimately, if you look back to our primary in 2008 between then-Senators Obama and Clinton, it was far more divisive than this primary has been. And frankly, I was really pleased coming out of the New York primary that 7 out of 10 of our Democratic primary voters that cast ballots there said that they were enthusiastic and were energized by our primary and about both of our candidates. And that's the same results that we saw coming out of Wisconsin, whereas the Republicans actually had, you know, much lower numbers, less than 40% in New York, and actually even less than, about that in Wisconsin as well. And so, in fact, you got Republican senators dropping like flies. McCain has now said that he's not even going to attend the Republican National Convention. Kelly Ayotte has said she won't. I mean, you've got many of their candidates who are really worried about whether they're going to actually get reelected, not wanting to associate with their really damaged brand.
I agree with you on the enthusiasm factor, and the polls do say that. But, for example, the polls are also find that Hillary Clinton, who by all accounts is the front runner in this nomination process, the headline in the Washington Post today, Hillary Clinton won New York, but her image is underwater. Is that concerning to you that the past few weeks, the attacks that have been going on against her will only escalate and hurt her more in the general?
Well, we know that this is going to be a rough and tumble election, and there hasn't been a presidential election in modern times, especially the last five or six, that, you know, because we are a evenly divided country, hasn't been a robust and spirited contest. And so, you know, we're expecting and preparing for a contest in the general election that is going to be a battle of the direction that we should take this country. And so that's what I think voters are going to be making their decisions on. They're going to listen to our candidate, no matter who it is, who talks about how we can help people reach the middle class. And they're going to listen to their candidate, very likely Donald Trump, almost for sure at this point, who has said that Mexicans are rapists and drug dealers and that we should deport 11 million undocumented immigrants and that, you know, maybe we should actually restart a nuclear proliferation in Europe I mean, this is unhinged, irrational policy that shows that Donald Trump does not understand what's at stake and has not taken this race seriously and is willing to say anything he needs to be able to incite voters on his side of the aisle.
Have you been surprised that elected officials, Democrats, third-party groups, regular people have not protested more just the very issues you're talking about with Donald Trump? I mean, he won. He had a big victory. He's had these victories over and over again. And as you say, the language is completely different than any other national candidate has ever been successful using. I mean, some of the things he said, Pat Buchanan said, but he didn't get this far.
Right. I mean, there certainly have been groups that have protested. And if you look at the numbers, as far as the popularity or lack thereof among Hispanic voters and, you know, Asian Pacific Islanders and women, I mean, Donald Trump is so underwater that it'll be virtually impossible for him to climb out. That's because he's been insulted his way through this campaign. And, I mean, this is not what the American people want to see in their president.
I know you say that, but it's for those of us who observe this very closely, it just doesn't still seem to have an impact on the voters. They're still going to him.
Because it's playing out on the Republican side. And so this is sadly the bed that the Republican Party has made, and they are lying in it now. I mean, they fomented and were willing to allow the extremism and the vitriol that really exploded onto the national scene in 2010 with the Tea Party, and basically welcomed it with open arms. And now they are, you know, claiming to be the victims of it. And as a result, they are about to nominate the most extreme, vitriolic, misogynistic, bigoted presidential candidate in history.
Are you a little empathetic to your counterpart, Reince Priebus, with his Twitter war last week with Donald Trump? Does any part of you say, I'm trying to beat this guy and his party, but boy, I feel badly for him?
I don't feel badly in terms of the bed that he's allowed to be made for himself and that Republicans have allowed. I mean, they, instead of pushing back and standing up for what was right, and I don't mean what the Democratic version of right is, I mean what the American version of right is, where we're not going to, you know, allow the government to, you know, write off entire groups of people. We're not going to fan the flames of division by encouraging a presidential candidate like Donald Trump, who said that he would be willing to bar an entire religion from entering this country. So because he did not exercise what I believe is the leadership he should have shown, that is part of the responsibility of the roles that we have as national party chairs, so I don't feel bad in that sense. But, you know, look, when it comes to the fact that both parties have rules that are part of the process that we take and go through to ultimately nominate a presidential candidate that represents our party, you know, I do feel for him there and agree that they have gone through their nominating process according to their rules. The candidates all knew the rules, as did we. And that's how we nominate presidential candidates in America. In that sense, we are on the same page, Reince Priebus and I, that our parties have both followed the rules and will continue to do that. And that's ultimately what both parties will use, even at the convention, to select our party's nominee.
Speaking of those rules, though, is there a path right now, given the number of delegates that have been accumulated by Hillary Clinton, is there a path for Bernie Sanders to win this nomination?
But, you know, Betsy, it's not for me to handicap the chances of either one of our candidates.
We have 19 primaries left.
Yeah. And so we're just going to have to see that play out and see what happens.
Right. I'm not asking you to handicap. I'm just asking you, just under the rules that exist now within the party that you were talking about, is it possible that he could get the nomination?
We're not at the stage where mathematically it's impossible. That's the most I can say.
And what about these allegations by the Sanders campaign that the Clinton campaign violated fundraising laws?
It's just simply completely and patently false. I mean, we have a joint fundraising agreement with both of our presidential candidates. Bernie Sanders has chosen not to raise money to assist the party, and he has chosen not to use that vehicle. for that purpose, and Secretary Clinton did choose to use it. And we have raised money with her, just like in every previous joint fundraising agreement with the, between the DNC and our presidential candidate. We followed the rules and followed the law and have done so, to the letter.
If Hillary Clinton does emerge as the nominee, what role do you see for Sanders in terms of the future of the party? And is there a reason for him to enter into discussions with you all?
And have you entered into any discussions yet?
About supporting or implementing any of his policy positions? What does that look like?
You know, it's premature to be discussing that. We have not discussed it with either one of our candidates. Mm-hmm. We have 19 primaries to go, and so this primary is still playing out. Mathematically, as you just asked me, it's still possible for either one of our candidates to ultimately be our nominee. And so until we reach the point where we have a presumptive nominee,
Right. Then
we're not entering into discussions like that. We're managing the primary and preparing for the general.
But it would be appropriate in either scenario to have discussions with the other candidate in terms of bringing
at the appropriate time. We definitely will do that. But now is not that time.
Yeah.
So I was just at the spring walkthrough. Thank you for your team and all their efforts
get
media set up and ready to go. It's pretty exciting.
It's
Philadelphia
exciting.
Looks amazing. But there is the question that sort of hangs over due to the fact that some large corporations have decided not to participate in the Democratic National Convention this year. What kind of adjustments have you had to make for that?
What they've decided is not to participate in the Republican National Convention. And so there are some companies that, because they have equity rules where they have to contribute to equally to both parties' conventions, because a number of companies have no interest in associating with the Republican National Committee at their convention, unfortunately, it's resulted in us losing their support as well. But it isn't, so significant for us that it's been impactful. We're on time, we're on task, and we're on budget for the convention, and looking forward to a fantastic convention that will help really showcase our party's nominee and the contrast between the two parties and the direction and our vision for the country.
So I also attended the Republican convention spring walkthrough. It's clear that the Rules Committee and other meetings will take place the week before. Indeed, it sounded as if their plan is to spend the entire week, whether it's for Rules Committee, protests, it sounds like all the fireworks are likely to happen the week before. I wonder if that's changing your preparations in any way, because by the time people get to, the Democratic convention, they might be pretty tired.
Well, the Republican National Convention was before ours last year as well. And although it didn't have the chaos that this Republican National Convention is likely to have, it did end with Clint Eastwood speaking to an empty chair.
Oh, yes.
And so that was a really interesting lead-in to the start of our convention. No, we're preparing for what we expect to be an exciting and unifying convention that will showcase the diversity of our party, showcase the priorities of our nominee, and help voters really get a clear sense that it is our party's nominee and the Democratic Party who continues to have the vision for America that most Americans embrace, and that we want to continue to build on the success we've had under President Obama, who pulled us out of the worst economic crisis that we had since the Great Depression. More than 15 million jobs, 73 straight months of job growth in the private sector, 20 million more people who have health insurance. And the Republicans are going to showcase how they want to take it back to what they call the glory days, when George W. Bush was president and he crashed our economy, got us into the worst economic situation since the Great Depression. And that's where they want to turn the clock back to.
How engaged do you think President Obama will be in this general election campaign?
How engaged? I expect him to be fully engaged. In fact, I know he will be. I've spoken to him about it as recently as a few days ago, and know that he is going to be out there on the trail campaigning for our nominee.
How do you explain Hillary Clinton's challenge with younger voters, and how do you as a party turn that around in a general election?
I think our party, regardless of which one of our candidates is ultimately our nominee, is going to have far more appeal to younger voters than anything the Republicans have to offer. I mean, look at what the Republicans did. In 2012, when they lost, my counterpart initiated that Republican autopsy. And, in part, they said, if we're going to ever win another presidential election, we have to embrace comprehensive immigration reform. We have to stop alienating large groups of minority voters and making them feel like that we don't welcome them into our party or into our country. We can see how well that's worked out for them. young voters who are less likely to identify with a party, but more likely to embrace the agenda that our party is offering, which is one that embraces diversity and inclusiveness and equality of opportunity, particularly economic opportunity. You know, what the Republicans have to offer is, you know, turning the clock back and, you know, returning to a time when we had policies that helped make sure big banks could get bigger and stronger and had more ability to run over consumers, and a time when you had a policy coming out of the Republican White House that really was isolationist and that got us involved in war that was misguided. What we've got to offer young people compared to what the Republicans do is the most stark contrast that younger voters, I think, will have had in recent years.
As you've observed this campaign, though, what do you think that Bernie Sanders has been able to tap into?
Bernie Sanders has been able to tap into and motivate a generation of young people who really want to see their candidates and their elected officials demonstrate that they have empathy, demonstrate that they understand what they're going through and who are voicing the angst that they have, that we need to make sure that we close the income gap and address income inequality, that we embrace pluralism and diversity, and that we create an environment that helps make sure more people can have access to the American dream. And, you know, on the Republican side, they're seeing, and it's really just an abomination. You're seeing states like Mississippi and North Carolina and Tennessee adopt discriminatory laws that really target the LGBT community and go in the opposite direction from the way most of America has gone. So, you know, that it's wonderful that Bernie Sanders has been able to appeal and ignite the excitement in that generation. And I'm confident that when we have a nominee, we'll continue their engagement and their involvement, no matter which one of our candidates it is.
You and George Clooney appeared on Meet the Press, and George Clooney said, "I think it's an obscene amount of money." And they're right to protest. They're absolutely right. It's an absolute obscene amount of money.
Right. I was actually on Meet the Press this weekend, immediately following his interview with Chuck Todd, and I agreed with him that there is an obscene amount of money in politics. And that was the question that I was asked, and it was the question that George Clooney was asked. He actually did that fundraiser for the Hillary Victory Fund, which largely benefited our 32 state Democratic parties and the Democratic National Committee, as well as the Clinton
and
campaign.
That's my question. My question is, when I saw that interview and I saw you on the show, it makes me think, mm-hmm. for people sitting at home in Pittsburgh and my family, when they hear that large amount of money and they hear what you're both saying, which is, you know, hey, this is the system, what are we going to do? No wonder people are discouraged from participating in the process, except for the angry people. Does that worry you, the impact of even that conversation, or do you think it's a help to explain it to people?
No, I think it's absolutely a help to explain it to people, because there is a growing understandable frustration with how much money in politics there is. We share that frustration. I mean, we've repeatedly, as Democrats in Congress, tried to get Republicans to take up legislation like the Disclose Act that would overturn parts of Citizens United and reduce the influence of opaque, non-transparent, huge, big money contributions that really overshadow the impact that voters, actual voters, have on choosing their elected officials. And further, to pass a constitutional amendment, because that's really the only way that we're going to comprehensively be able to address the Citizens United decision, which is the decision that was handed down by the Supreme Court, as both of you know, that basically turned campaign finance laws on its head and made it so that these huge corporations and big money donors are able, far beyond the contributors at one event this weekend, but these super PACs that are able to dump a ton of money into one small congressional race and overturn essentially what feels like they're overturning the will of the voters. That's unacceptable. We disagree with it. We want the Republicans to join us in making sure that we can restore some balance, and they have no interest whatsoever in doing that because they like the system the way it is.
Speaking of all the outside money and super PACs, do you think that there's more of a diminished role of the political parties on both sides? Sort of what do you see as the future role of the political parties with so much outside money and with campaigns able to get their data from elsewhere? What is the role of the National Political Party now?
We still have a very significant role, one that is not replicable by any other organization or entity, and that is because we, for example, there might be other smaller, not as well, not as well organized voter files available. But from the Democratic National Committee's perspective, we own the Obama voter file and have built on top of that and added to its value. We now share it with candidates up and down the ballot, and so just the fact that they can, candidates can access the most comprehensive voter file in the country through our party, the ability of our party to organize with our state parties. I mean, that's the only way that candidates can really get access to a coordinated campaign and take advantage, for example, of the cheaper advertising dollar that they can get through advertising, with the side by side with the Democratic Party. And the same with postage. There's a advantage that you get when it comes to postage and communicating with voters through the mail. So we have very significant and relevance. But, we definitely have a smaller footprint, and our smaller footprint is the result of there being this obscene amount of outside cash that has, really tipped the scales in such a way that we really have outside undue influence that is really hard to keep track of influencing the outcome of our elections. And in the old days, you at least knew that the money flowed through the political parties, and the campaign finance laws require any money that comes through our coffers and for the RNC and the DNC has to be transparent and reported and accountable. So that's a big difference.
So for a final question, I have to ask you, I don't know if you had a chance to watch the HBO film this weekend, Confirmation, but my real question is, it was 25 years ago when Anita Hill testified at the Clarence Thomas hearing. And, of course, it changed everything for women on the Hill and some say in the nation. And I just wanted to ask you, do you remember those hearings? Did you watch? And do you think you'd be one of the leaders of your party 25 years later?
You know, I did watch them. I was actually just elected to the state legislature. It was 25 years ago when those hearings were occurring. And I remember I watched, I think, every bit of them. And when I was elected to the legislature, we adopted policies that helped women address sexual harassment and made sure that practices that took place, because I was a staffer before I was elected to the legislature, and I saw things that were appalling that women who worked there had no idea how to deal with and just kind of had to absorb and accept. And thanks to Anita Hill, thanks to her willingness to stand up and give voice to what so many women all across the country in professional environments had been subjected to, there are workplace policies that are required now that every employee has to go through a training to make sure that they know how to act appropriately in the work environment and what is and isn't appropriate and unwelcome treatment, which is defined by the person who is targeted by that treatment, is never acceptable in a professional environment. And that was incredibly important for women.
What is next for you professionally? Are you going to stay in your role as DNC chairman, or what are your future?
My term is concurrent with President Obama's. So my term as DNC chair ends the day after he leaves office and the new president is inaugurated. And I'm running for re-election to Congress and look forward to continuing to serve my constituents. And will, be campaigning to earn that privilege once again.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Madam
Chairman.
Thank
you very much. Thanks to you both.
Well, we all know that behind every great man, there is an even greater woman. And this holds true for successful politicians as well. Not surprisingly, some of the biggest masters in politics, otherwise known as U.S. presidents, have talented women at their side on the campaign trail. So we wanted to spend some time talking about these women with author and journalist Kate Anderson Brower, whose brand new book is called First Women, The Grace and Power of America's Modern First Ladies. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you, Betsy and Tammy, for having me.
Thanks for
being here. In addition to being a friend or a former colleague in television news, so we're happy to have you here with us. And Our listeners may already know you from your wildly successful book of last year called The Residence Inside the Private World of the White House. And here you are with the second book. Tell us how you came up with this idea for the second book.
So I came up with the idea for First Women when I was working on The Residence, and I interviewed a lot of butlers and maids who talked about their relationships with the first ladies they've served since Jackie Kennedy. And they would say that when a decision came from the first lady, they would say it came from the second floor. And that's where the first family lives, of course, on the second and third floor is the White House. So I was really interested to find out who these women are. We just know about them. They're kind of icons. And when I was a Bloomberg reporter, I remember, you know, covering Michelle Obama and really having very little sense of, you know, her personality, but also what she goes through as first lady. So that really gave me the inspiration to start researching this book.
And she is one that you write about who doesn't enjoy politics.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she's counting down the days until she can leave the White House. And that's so interesting. You know, I interviewed a senior Obama staffer who said, you know, he has children around the same age as Sasha and Malia. And around soccer season, he would kind of roll his eyes and say, God, I'm going to be stuck in carpools all weekend. And she would say, you know, you have no idea how much I miss that. And just being able to roll down a car window, she's talked about how difficult simple things like that are. So unlike Hillary Clinton, she really is looking forward to leaving the White House.
But she's this immensely popular first lady, which I assume that means that they want her out on the campaign trail for midterms, et cetera, as much as possible. She doesn't like it very much. And you have a great story in there about when Rahm Emanuel was chief of staff and tried to get her to do something. And she said, not so fast.
Yeah, I mean, she would always push back. So I interviewed her first chief of staff, Jackie Norris, and she said she was constantly saying, you know, you have to have an exact reason for why I'm doing this. She just doesn't want to go out and just do anything. But both Hillary and Michelle Obama didn't particularly love Rahm Emanuel. They thought he was a difficult personality to work with, and they thought that he was trying to
That's shocking to hear, Kate.
I know. Isn't it surprising?
Well, is it
so they
sexism,
have, like, a mutual bond
it...
over that.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that Michelle thought it was kind of unfair that, you know, just because she was popular, it shouldn't mean that her whole life should be spent
over,
on the
yeah.
campaign trail.
Is it sexism, do you think, Kate, that they felt sexism for Rahm Emanuel?
Oh, God. I wouldn't want to say. But, I mean, I think there is definitely some of that. And, you know, I have a whole chapter in the book called East Wing versus West Wing. And again you see that. I mean, Pat Nixon being treated just horribly by Richard Nixon's chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, who, you know, referred to her as Thelma behind her back, which was her given name, and which she never used and hated. And there is just this sense for decades the women of the East Wing have kind of been subjected to the whims of the West Wing. The East Wing women do not get treated, the aides even don't get treated with the same kind of respect as they should be by the mostly male West Wing staff still, right? So it's there's definitely that kind of adversarial relationship. You know, the East Wing staff in the Obama White House refers to themselves as Guam, and I think that's so funny that they feel kind of like they're the outsiders, and sometimes they're left out of meetings, which causes tension.
And you wrote about Pat Nixon, that she was prepared to be the first lady in 1960 when her husband first ran, but by the time we get, you know, further down the line, she did not even want him to run later. She had had enough of it.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, in 1960, she was so ready for it. She had trained at Mamie Eisenhower's knee. I mean, for 8 years, she learned about how to be a 1950s, you know, first lady. But by the time 1968 rolled around, they finally won. And there's this great letter that Jackie Kennedy sent to Pat Nixon saying, you know, I know this path has been long and hard for you, and I hope you and your family will find some peace in the glare of the spotlight and all this. It was kind of a passive-aggressive dig from Jackie to Pat. But she didn't fit the times in the late 60s when you had, like, the feminist movement kicking off in the early 70s, you know. So she would have been a much better first lady had she, you know, gotten to be first lady in 1960. But she took that loss really personally and was just shattered when they lost in 1960. And you can see video and photos of her crying at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles when he, you know, when Richard Nixon conceded.
And you write that her nickname in the White House was Plastic Pat because she was so exhausted from playing the role of political wife all those years.
Yeah, it's really, you know, you feel kind of, I feel a level of sympathy for her. I mean, I think that she never really kind of came to grips with Watergate, and kind of they left in the White House in such a cloud of shame. And, you know, but I interviewed her chief of staff who, you know, told me, you know, what first lady is understood? It's the king, it's not the queen. Mm-hmm. And I love that quote because it says so much about how little we know about these women.
So true. Now, someone we do know a lot about is obviously Hillary Clinton, who's running for president again. And can you give us a little background on how she came into politics? I know people always thought that, you know, she made a mistake by sort of moving her friends, said she made a mistake by going to Arkansas with Bill Clinton because she was sort of shortchanging her own potential political career. Tell us about Hillary Clinton, the early politician.
I mean, she gave up a lot to be with Bill Clinton. And you're right, her friends thought that she should run for office. And she said she followed her heart. And, you know, and she did, you know, it's interesting to look at Hillary Clinton because, you know, she's the only former first lady to run for office herself. We see her in such a public way right now. But even from the very beginning, from early times, she was playing the game so well. I mean, in Arkansas, she would get criticism for not changing her name. You know, she kept her maiden name when she was practicing law. One of these guys who was kind of sexist, you know, in Arkansas said to her, you know, I just don't know why you won't change your name. And she said, it's because I love my daddy so much, and kind of batted her eyes. And she plays. And that is such a smart response to, you know, an old Southern guy who's just kind of getting a jab in. And it just shows how smart she was back then. And, you know, she had them wrapped around their finger by the end of that. And then in 92, you know, when President Clinton first ran, she came out really fighting, and, you know, she would talk about H.W. Bush's time in the White House as a failure of leadership in a Vanity Fair article, which I think is so interesting. She went on the record talking about an alleged affair that H.W. Bush had, which, as a person who, you know, was on the campaign trail, we don't see these women now like Melania Trump or Heidi Cruz directly engaging in the campaign. It's almost like they're caught in this proxy war. You know, they're on Twitter. Their husbands are talking about them. But I think I would argue that in the past, these women have been more powerful and more engaged, like Lady Bird, who campaigned for Lyndon Johnson. It's almost like we've stepped back.
And you write about Lady Bird that Senator Kennedy, actually when LBJ was Kennedy's running mate in 1960, asked her to take a defining role in the campaign. And she was great on the campaign trail.
Yeah, I mean, Robert Kennedy said that she won the South for them, and she was just an amazing, you know, pinch hitter. And Jackie Kennedy's aides would call her Saint Bird, you know, because when Jackie did this, one of her polite brush-offs, and the acronym was a PBO, in the White House, where she would just not feel like doing certain events that first ladies have to do, they would call in Lady Bird Johnson, and she always obliged and did her job and did it quite well. But in 1964, she did this Lady Bird special, where she was the first lady to campaign on her own without her husband. And she campaigned across 8 southern states. And really, this was after the Civil Rights Act was passed. There was a lot of animosity. There were people shouting, Blackbird, go home. And she just dealt with it. I mean, she was an emissary to the South because there was a lot of anger towards Lyndon Johnson at the time because of the Civil Rights Act. And she was an incredibly powerful woman and such an amazing writer. She has this diary of her years in the White House that I just love.
There, Melissa Leo plays her in the soon-to-be-released HBO film All the Way. Bryan Cranston plays LBJ, and she plays such a significant role. I think people are really going to enjoy it. I have to ask you about Barbara Bush, who we saw again this season, this campaign season, on the trail with her son, Jeb. Can you talk about her? And were you surprised that she came back out for her son again? I know she's had some health struggles, but she was really out there.
Yeah, they would call her the silver fox in the White House, you know, and H.W. Bush would kind of say to reporters, well, watch out, the silver fox is mad at you, you know. They used her kind of as an attack dog sometimes. I mean, she's very tough, and she's an interesting woman because she's also got that grandmotherly kind of sweetness to her, but behind the scenes, she does not take criticism well of her husband or her son. And so I'm not that surprised that she would go out in support of Jeb. Of course, what she said when, you know, I don't remember the exact quote, but we don't need another Bush in the White House or whatever she said, that got, that's Barbara Bush's kind of candor and how blunt she is. And you can see that again and again after Hillary Clinton did this Vanity Fair story where she alluded to this alleged affair that H.W. Bush had. Ever since then, Barbara Bush and Hillary Clinton just, I mean, they have a terrible relationship, even though Bill Clinton and H.W. Bush are close, so that whenever there were Kennebunkport meetings, you don't see Hillary Clinton there with Bill Clinton, which I think is interesting. It's like the women can't give up these grudges. They're kind of the grudge holders for the family in some cases. And the tough, really, the sort of power behind the throne in a lot of cases.
Well, maybe they're the only ones that could be angry, because if you're president, you've got to get the job done, right?
Right. But the Bill Clinton, H.W. Bush kind of father-son bond is so fascinating. It goes beyond what I think you'd expect from them, right? It's kind of amazing that they've been able to move forward.
And what about President Bush 43 and Laura Bush? What have you learned about them in writing this book?
I've learned that Laura Bush and Michelle Obama are very close and that their personalities really mesh. And I think a lot of this book is about the sisterhood of these women and the commonalities that kind of don't have anything to do with political party and everything to do with personality. I thought it was really interesting that it's kind of like in House of Cards that George W. Bush and Laura Bush would sit in the treaty room on the second floor of the White House many nights after dinner and sort of crack the window there and smoke. And he would smoke a cigar, she would smoke cigarettes, and the Secret Service were always so concerned that they would forget to close the window. So they had to have like this system in place with the ushers where someone made sure that the window was closed at night. But it's interesting, I mean, that he was listening to her advice and she was involved. And Laura Bush is not, you know, she's a very smart woman. And like all of these women, she has opinions, and she was the first lady to give a presidential radio address after 9/11. And I think she's underestimated in a lot of ways, too.
And she's done a lot of work post-presidency for women and girls in Afghanistan, and she's stayed very active in that regard as well.
I interviewed her, and when I talked to her, she said, you know, she feels, she understands that she comes to the White House. She came to the White House with a very unique situation. She knew all the staff by their first names. She had stayed there when her mother-in-law and father-in-law were in the White House, and she knew the drill. So I think from like a day-to-day perspective, it was a lot easier for Laura Bush to move into the White House than it was for Michelle Obama. And so I think that Laura feels like she has to kind of help Michelle. I mean, she gave her a tour of the White House where she showed her Sasha and Malia's rooms first and tried to tell her that, you know, you can have a life here for your family and for your daughters. It's very sweet.
I think Laura Bush and President Bush, they have this unique balance. So she sort of brings out a different side of him. And you write about Rosalynn Carter, too, and how she sort of was able to do some things on the campaign trail that her husband wasn't able to do in terms of connecting with people.
She is just a really amazing campaigner. I mean, she would memorize people's names, and she actually took memory classes to help him, and also, you know, told him when he was repeating jokes and all of that, because she was really by his side. And then when he was dealing with the Iran hostage crisis, she was out campaigning. She would call in for daily updates, was really involved. I interviewed Walter Mondale, their vice president, and he said, there is not a secret in the White House that Rosalynn Carter doesn't know about. She knew everything. She had a way of connecting with people that the president didn't. And, you know, I interviewed Jerry Rafshoon, who was their communications director and is still close with them. And he said that Rosalynn has a much better judge of character, you know, in some ways than Jimmy Carter. She's able to read people because he's focused on other things. So, I mean, she was very helpful to him.
Were you surprised that Secretary Clinton was criticized for her comments, positive comments about Nancy Reagan at her funeral?
Yes, I was surprised by that because I watched the funeral and I didn't think about that. I mean, I guess she made those in an MSNBC. It was an interview that she.
Yeah, I think with Andrea Mitchell.
Yes. And I was surprised, and I forget exactly what she said. I mean, of course.
She praised her efforts.
But it was about AIDS.
Yes. Right.
And critics jumped out that said, you know, hey, she didn't.
Right.
They didn't
and
do
I
very
think
much
that,
early
you know,
on.
Yeah.
Do you guys think this that might, I mean, my initial reaction to that was that Hillary Clinton has been on the campaign trail for so long, she's so exhausted that I think she might have just gotten kind of confused, and maybe she was thinking about Barbara Bush, who famously hugged children with AIDS and did a lot for the AIDS crisis. And so I think she might have gotten confused, because Hillary Clinton is somebody who studied all these women, knows a lot about the history of the White House and the First Lady. So I would have to say that seemed like she was exhausted. But I was, yeah, I mean, I was surprised. She doesn't slip up very often, so it was surprising.
Well, but didn't Nancy Reagan, after they left the White House, sort of step in much later?
Yeah. But, I mean, the big criticism is, of course, that they didn't do enough in the White House.
Well, when they should have and could have and all of that.
Yeah.
I was just surprised by the rancor that, you know, she is passed and there's so many new fights. I'm not saying they're wrong.
Yeah, but
it just took my breath away. And part of me felt like, well, this is terrific. We're talking about women and the impact of this First Lady, you know, 20 years before. Doesn't that say something? Just like your book, it says, my goodness, these folks have had a lot for many years, have made such a big difference. Of course, Michelle Obama back to Let's Move and all those campaigns now.
Yeah, absolutely. And like Rosalynn Carter, who had the mental health issue, which she took on really early, and we talk about it all the time now, tying it with gun control, of course, but she was really ahead of her time with that. And one thing that she feels like, you know, Michelle Obama and Hillary Clinton really haven't reached out enough to ask for advice from Rosalynn Carter. You know, that she is kind of the first lady who, as a, you know, wife of a one-term president, I think feels a bit ostracized from this group, from this sisterhood. You know,
there are sort of those pictures of all the first ladies and she's sort of standing off to the side, right?
Yes, and I think that says a lot. I mean, there's this great picture of them all at the Botanical Garden. It's a black and white photo, and Nancy Reagan and Rosalynn Carter are kind of looking off to the side, and Lady Bird is talking with Hillary, like whispering with each other, and Betty Ford and Barbara Bush are talking, and they were really close. But those two, Nancy and Rosalynn, weren't really close with the other women, which I think is interesting.
Are there any specific characteristics for a Republican First Lady versus a Democrat? I mean, do they share any points of view, or is it has nothing to do with political parties?
I mean, that's a great question. I really think it has nothing to do with political party. And that's why, especially now with what's going on with this election, you just think about how, you know, if the relationship between a Heidi Cruz and Melania Trump right now, I mean, in, you know, 8 or 10 years, would they ever be friends? Probably not, because they have these long memories going back. But there isn't one unifying thing. I mean, it's just empathy that they all have. They all eventually have for each other after they, you know, serve in the White House, and how hard the job is, and that there's no job description, and these are wives and mothers, and that's why it's interesting to see letters, like I found these great letters at presidential libraries between them that show this lifelong bond. Like Lady Bird Johnson had a framed photograph of Betty Ford on her nightstand until she died.
Wow.
And, you know, I mean, they really loved each other, and Lady Bird in particular, getting back to, you know, All the Way and all that, she was so fascinating, and she was the most interested in the other first ladies. I mean, she left all these incredible letters where she would reach out to them during difficult times, and she actually asked President Clinton to pardon one of her friends in Texas, and he did it. So she also used her power long after the Johnsons left the White House.
What is your favorite presidential library? I ask you as a presidential library nerd, along with my husband. What library is your favorite?
Physically, I think the Reagan Library is so beautiful, you know.
No, you can't. When you get Air Force One in your library, it's hard to really compete.
And the view out there
is gorgeous. The view just takes your breath away.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And Nancy Reagan, you know, used to go every year on the anniversary of Ronald Reagan's death and sit there by herself at his grave and with just her Secret Service agent there. And I just think, and the library staff was telling me that they would just see, they knew when she was coming, and it was a very kind of somber thing. But, like, the dedication these women have to their husbands is incredible.
And their stamp is really on their libraries. I remember going to the Bush 43 library, and you could tell the hand that Laura Bush had in creating that library as well.
Yeah, I mean, Lady Bird visited every presidential library before she worked on the Johnson Library to, you know, see what they did right and what she could emulate. And, I mean, they care a lot about the libraries. And that's why with the Kennedy Library, you know, the Reagans actually helped raise money for the Kennedy Library because, of course, they were at a real lost because they didn't have the president to help raise money, and it was
right.
really hard. And so that's what's interesting about the Jackie Kennedy-Nancy Reagan friendship, or at least respect that Jackie had for Nancy Reagan coming and helping raise money for the library, and also what Nancy Reagan did to bring a sense of glamour back to the White House after Rosalynn Carter. At least Jackie Kennedy felt that it was nice that Nancy was inviting Frank Sinatra to the White House. I mean, Jackie was really obsessed, obviously, with appearances and how the White House looked and what people, you know, the proper respect. And the Carters were much more laid back about all that stuff.
And what about Jackie Kennedy? So much has been, first as a writer, to attempt to write anything about
right.
her. What did you learn? What was new? What surprised you?
Well, I didn't know about her visit to the White House in 1971. The first time she and her children went back to the White House after President Kennedy's assassination. Lady Bird, you know, had tried to get her to come back. Jackie wouldn't come. It was too fresh and too painful. And so she went when Pat Nixon asked her to. And, you know, the Nixon sent a plane to pick them up. And Caroline was 13 and John Kennedy Jr. was 10. And they went to the White House for this, you know, to see the president's official portrait. And it was this very moving thing. It was in Jackie later wrote to Pat Nixon saying, you know, can you imagine the gift you gave my family? The day I always dreaded turned out to be one of the most wonderful days I spent with my children. And I think that that says a lot about this kind of bipartisan, you know, I mean, Pat Nixon felt a lot of sympathy for Jackie and what she went through. And I think also just the extent of how much Jackie knew about her husband's cheating. I didn't realize, you're right, so much has been written about her, but I didn't realize, you know, I read through a ton of great oral histories and that she was really aware of what was going on. She was very smart.
And I was also amazed at the story that you have in there about Jackie during the Cuban Missile Crisis with her husband. Not only was she just mm-hmm. a complete confidant of him during that time, but the story that you have about her kind of walking out, that they tried to show her where the bunker is. And will you tell the story?
She was told, you know, that there was, and the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, was the closest that we've come to nuclear war. And it was, I mean, it was just so frightening at the time. And she was told about this bunker, and she absolutely refused. She said, you know, if anything happens, I want to stay here with Jack, and the kids do too, and we're not going anywhere. We're going to stand on the South Lawn. And it's just incredible how brave she was. And also, you know, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, like you said, she was a confidant to him, and she was never happier than she was in the White House. I mean, she felt so useful. She used to say she was a liability to her husband, and then suddenly she used to think she was too rich and too beautiful, and, you know, it was a tough life for her. But, you know, she felt like she was a liability to him on the campaign trail, and now once she was in the White House and women everywhere, you know, recognized her style and were copying her, she was finally an asset to him. And I think and she also thought her hips were too wide. One of her friends told me that, and I just thought that was amazing.
Oh,
that
God.
Even Jackie Kennedy, you know, is insecure. That's hard to believe, but I think that's kind of should make people feel like, you know, they're human too.
Exactly, exactly. Well, Kate, congratulations on the book. It's really a wonderful read, and we're delighted that you were here with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It was fun.
Special thanks to Democratic Chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz and our author and friend, Kate Brower. This is Tammy Haddad with Betsy Fisher Martin, and this is Bloomberg Masters in Politics. Thank you, Mark Halpern and John Heilemann, and Feature Story News, especially Priscilla Huff.